victims of the war in Afghanistan. Making this documentary film was very difficult because we had to risk our lives when we went among Taliban forces. We even took part in several Taliban operations to make this documentary film.
One of the special features about this documentary is that they have shown the inner side of the Taliban, which is very dangerous and difficult. Making such a documentary will definitely raise public awareness about the real nature of such groups, which is of course so risky for the filmmakers.
The production of this documentary took 19 months to complete. The documentary's director says it has unveiled a big secret called Taliban and clearly has responded to questions which have for long been formed in the minds of international audiences regarding the nature of the militant group.
The documentary film, Life Among War Flags, takes a deeper look at the lives of Afghan people who have tolerated years of war and bloodshed under different names and have learned to show flexibility to survive. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki and the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, are on a collision course. The Commission is demanding that Warsaw adheres to a recent EU Court of Justice ruling that Poland's disciplinary procedure for judges violates EU law.
We will ask for financial sanctions if Poland does not remedy the situation by the 16th of August. Let me repeat that we have said many times, EU law has primacy over national law.
The Commission has just published its 2021 EU Rule of Law report. It highlights concerns surrounding justice systems and corruption. The Commission says it's examining allegations that EU member Hungary has used spyware to hack into the phones of those criticizing Viktor Orban's government.
We will use all the possible tools to receive more information on this. So, of course, at the internal level, with the different services of the Commission, we are starting, you mentioned, investigations. We are starting to collect information.
Other EU countries criticized in the Rule of Law report include Bulgaria, Croatia and Slovenia. Recently, Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša participated in the annual conference of the MKO terrorist organization, sometimes referred to as the MEK. The terrorist group wants to oust the democratically elected government in Iran. Via Skype, former Portuguese MEP Ana Gomes says that the group is mainly funded by Saudi Arabia and Israel.
MEK pays people to participate in their events. So my question is, how much has Prime Minister Janša been paid by MEK?
Critics say the EU is quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations over alleged rule of law breaches, but is very slow to take action when some of its own 27 member states flout basic standards. The Commission's annual Rule of Law report repeatedly highlights the importance of media freedom. It's ironic because the EU's closest ally, the United States, continues to block .com media outlets operated from Iran, including PressTV.com. However, people can still log on using PressTV.ir. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There seems to be no end in sight to the tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, the US and some of its Western allies, including the UK, have publicly accused actors affiliated with the Chinese government of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email platform used by corporations. That has escalated the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing, with the Chinese foreign ministry slamming its quote fabricated allegation.
The U.S. has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept.
For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. Last week, China was infuriated further after the U.S. administration warned American companies and investors about the increasing risk of operating in Hong Kong. Washington claimed that those companies face multiple threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data foreign firms store there. the South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over these strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. London has now announced it would permanently deploy two warships to Asian waters. That despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over their military activities in the region. It seems the U.S. and its allies are concerned about China's growing influence around the globe. That was visible in a recent G7 meeting where the leaders of seven wealthy nations agreed to counter China's economic and security influences. U.S. President Joe Biden even urged European and Japanese leaders to offer hundreds of billions in loans to developing countries in a direct challenge to Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's global infrastructure development strategy. Beijing's relations with Washington reached the lowest ebb during the administration of President Donald Trump, who waged a tariff war on it. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under Trump's successor Joe Biden, but he has shown no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies toward China. That has helped bring the Asian powerhouse closer to Russia, with both forming an invisible alliance. Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington sees as a threat to its global hegemony.
The village of Vaux-sur-Chevremont on the outskirts of Liège has been devastated. Seven people lost their lives in last week's floods here. Hundreds have been forced to flee their homes.
When the water comes, I see it in my foot. I say, well, okay, we go home. But the water not in my foot come here, and I don't know what to say.
Meteorologists claim 2 months' rain fell here in just 2 days. It's being described as the worst natural disaster for eastern Belgium and western Germany in living memory. However, how natural is it? Climate change is being blamed. Also, there is criticism surrounding planning. Many towns and villages in Europe were constructed on floodplains. Some residents have been told it could be up to 8 months before their homes will be habitable again.
We lost our fridge. We don't even know where he is. He disappeared in the river. Everything is damaged. We have to do everything again.
There was also severe flooding in Netherlands, France and Luxembourg, but there's no doubt Germany and Belgium were hit hardest. Many thousands of homes that were not destroyed are still without electricity, water and gas supplies. It might take weeks before those are restored. Aside from the tragic loss of life, the floods have caused billions of euro worth of damage. Serious questions surround the effectiveness of the EU's flood warning system. Reviews will now be conducted to find out if all this human suffering could have been avoided.
When we get out of the house was the worst moment, because we have the feeling that we have lost everything and let it there and don't save anything.
The European Commission says it stands ready to provide whatever assistance is required. Throughout Tuesday, flags will be flown at half-mast in Belgium as the country observes a national day of mourning. Jerome Hughes in the village of Vaux-sur-Chevremont, Belgium.
The morning of Eid al-Adha, Yemenis from all walks of life came together in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to call on the international community to redouble efforts to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade imposed on the country.
We are here for the sixth Eid, demonstrating in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. The international body has not fulfilled its duty towards the Yemeni people. More than 6 years have passed and we have been subjected to an absurd war that killed thousands of Yemenis. We demand the international community to lift the siege imposed on the Yemeni people and release the oil ships that have already obtained entry permits by the United Nations.
Protesters blasted the United Nations for remaining silent toward the Saudi suffocating siege on Yemen. They called on the international community to take real measures to stop the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We are still protesting in front of the United Nations office, especially on religious occasions, in order to expose to the world the complicity between the United Nations and the Saudi-led coalition, including piracy against Yemeni oil ships despite obtaining UN permits.
Since June 2020, Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued illegal seizure of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia. The fuel crisis has heavily affected the health sector and left the war-torn country in a desperate struggle to survive.
After 6 years of war and blockade, Yemenis say the United Nations has not yet done anything to stop Saudi actions against their country. They accuse the international body of providing political cover for Riyadh's violations of international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi,
Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. and I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The UK has called for a complete overhaul of the Northern Ireland Protocol, a key part of the Brexit agreement that Prime Minister Boris Johnson reached with the EU in 2019. On Wednesday, Brexit Minister David Frost issued a new command paper that would radically revamp the Northern Ireland Protocol, which he himself negotiated. Frost's new proposal was rejected by the EU, with the European Commission saying that we will not agree to a renegotiation of the protocol. The Northern Ireland Protocol is a main component of the Brexit withdrawal agreement, whose main goal is to maintain an open land border between Britain's Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland in order to facilitate the free movement of goods. The protocol, which only came into force in January, has led to additional checks and delays on goods entering Northern Ireland from Britain. Joining us now is our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, who's with us from Brussels. Jerome, how far apart are the EU and the UK on the issue of Northern Ireland?
There's no doubt, Bardier, that they are very far apart, and really there's no sign right now of any hope in terms of them coming to some sort of a resolution. I mean, from the UK side, they're saying it's unacceptable that this Northern Ireland protocol is creating so much friction in terms of goods that are moving from Britain to Northern Ireland. And what the European Commission is saying is that, look, we are willing to examine any proposals and look at them in good faith, but it has to be within the parameters of the Northern Ireland Protocol. That the Northern Ireland Protocol is effectively the only show in town. It's an international agreement. Both sides knew exactly what was in it. And now you have a situation whereby the UK government is rowing backwards. And when you speak to senior officials here in Brussels, they have this feeling that, you know, Boris Johnson's arrogance is somewhat being fueled by the fact that he has such a big majority in Parliament. You remember the 2019 landslide victory that he had during the general election, and actually increased the number of seats, Tory seats, by 48. And now they have a majority of 80 seats in the House of Commons. And before that, you had Theresa May's government, which was being propped up by the DUP. So Northern Ireland unionists had a big say in what went on. In fact, they were able to scupper an agreement she reached with Brussels because they felt that there was a situation where there was this status being given to Northern Ireland, and effectively it made them less British. They consider themselves completely British. They don't want anything that aligns themselves more closely with the Republic of Ireland and the EU vis-a-vis the rest of the UK. And so they had power when Theresa May was in power. But with Boris Johnson, they don't have that. So Boris Johnson is able to, he feels he's very politically strong, and on paper that's, there's no doubt about that, that he is. But unionists feel disenfranchised, and the European Union considers Boris Johnson and his government to be completely unreliable, completely untrustworthy, that anything that they actually do agree, that, you know, the UK side could back down at any point. And you've never seen relations so bad between the EU and the UK. Don't forget, it's not that long ago, the UK was a member of the European Union, a strong member of the EU. Now they just look more and more like enemies. And, you know, one of the bad situations here, it could be a situation whereby you could have an all-out trade war between the EU and the UK. But perhaps the worst-case scenario, Bardia, would be if we saw a situation of violence breaking out in Northern Ireland, because the patience of unionists is running out. Okay, we don't have a hard border yet between the Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, but even so, this fact that this status has been given to Northern Ireland, which just differentiates it from the rest of the UK, unionists just are not happy about that at all.
All right, thanks a lot, Jerome Hughes, joining us from Brussels. Well, joining us, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsenopoulos, joining us from the British capital, London. And also writer and political analyst John White is joining us from Edinburgh. Well, let's start off with Mr. Saeed Mohsenopoulos from the British capital, London. Mr. Abbas, welcome to Spotlight. Britain has demanded that the EU overhauls the Northern Ireland Protocol just a year after it was agreed. Why have the Tories changed their tune on the NI Protocol?
I think what partly your reporter said, that there is an arrogance and there's a sense that Britain can do what it likes within this government that they have in office at the moment. It's very, very unrealistic. But they are constantly pushing and hustling for breaking of more and more rules and regulations that they've agreed to. I mean, this has become a track record. You know, the latest one, it's obviously laughably started off with a row over sausages, but that's kind of a red herring. You know, there has been a whole situation where the proposed ban on fresh Great British sausages in Northern Ireland could very effectively be banned. But that's a bit of a red herring, because there are, according to Northern Ireland businesses themselves, much bigger problems that are looming. And even though this ban is due to take effect, this protocol is due to take effect in October, it seems that these looming problems are increasing, and the central one is the amount of administration needed for actually shifting food from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. Of course, they're meant to do the checks now at the Northern Ireland border, which prevented them that happening at the Northern Ireland border, which actually, of course, has disturbed the unionists as well, those people who don't want to see any shifting of the relationship of Northern Ireland with Britain. So they've started murmuring, of course, saying that anything that looks like they have to be creating any kind of nominal border between mainland Britain and Northern Ireland, for them, is a red line. And so, of course, there have been allegations of threats being made to people in the export sort of section there on the coastlines, but in reality, it's kind of a perfect storm that people are arguing is building up. But normally, I mean, food products entering the single market require a complicated piece of administration, and that's known as the Export Health Certificate (EHC). But supermarkets currently don't need those for most products moving from GB to Northern Ireland. That's due to change in October, which will effectively be part of a perfect storm. And that's what people are really worried about. What are the consequences of this, really, as to what will happen beyond October?
Let's cross over to John White in Edinburgh. Mr. White, the EU, they immediately rejected the call coming from Britain, saying that Britain needed to respect its international obligations, and pointed out that it had been negotiated by Prime Minister Boris Johnson. This wasn't imposed on Britain. It was an agreement that was negotiated. Why doesn't London want to honor its own handiwork?
Well, a government that fails or refuses to abide by its obligations enshrined in internationally binding agreements instantly becomes the government of a pariah state, and that's what Brexit has ushered into being. Britain is now a pariah state. Boris Johnson lied in the run-up to the 2019 election when he said there will be frictionless trade between the EU and the island of Ireland, and now he is sowing dragon's teeth. He is trying to play to his newly acquired red wall working class base in the deindustrialised north and midlands of England and South Wales, and he's going to dial up the xenophobia, the anti-Europe xenophobia, the base British nationalism. Look out for the Churchillian rhetoric and the references to the Second World War. This is a government of rogues, and it's a government of rogues brought into being by a nation of sheep, in the words of Edward R. Murrow. The EU is doing nothing wrong here. It's only asking for the UK government, led by Boris Johnson, to abide by its agreement. There was no coercion. There was no sleight of hand. It was agreed in the context of the Brexit negotiations in 2018-2019, and the Britain already is trying to break those agreements in order to assuage a unionist rump in the north of Ireland that has nothing to offer the people of that province other than sectarianism, other than bigotry. That is where we are now.
Let's go over some comments from the British Business Secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng. Said on Thursday, a deal is a deal, but it wasn't something that was going to last forever. He also claimed the agreement wasn't written in stone. Well, they don't write agreements in stone anymore. It was written into international law. Unpack these comments for us, please.
Again, it's slithery comments. They're kind of really get-out techniques, which politicians use very, very regularly when they don't want to abide by international rule of law. You see, of course, Donald Trump, Britain's partner across the West Asia, has been breaking these laws. It's become a kind of a precedent that's been set, unilaterally pulling out of trade deals, not agreeing things. I mean, it seems like Britain definitely is catching that habit from the Americans. And I think the problem with what they're doing, of course, is added to what's going on with COVID-19 and the exodus of a lot of the immigrant workforce at the ground level, what you're seeing is a dangerous accumulation of factors which could actually impact on supplies to supermarkets in Britain. I mean, if they continue as they are, what with this kind of business with Brexit and adding to the problems that they potentially got, there are already murmurings that the army may be on standby to have to deliver certain foods, because a lot of the vegetables and the market place is suffering because of potential lack of drivers even being able to take products to goods. So the last thing Britain really needs is more, headaches like this. But under the protocol, it was agreed that Northern Ireland would continue to follow EU rules on product standards to prevent checks along the border. Checks would instead take place on goods entering Northern Ireland, as I said. But the bottom line is the agreement that the British government is clearly trying to renege on all of this. They want a complete new negotiation. The EU is saying we're not having any of it. What we've got in terms of the protocol, we're going to do everything within those boundaries. There is an Article 16 locked within the protocol, which does allow for some flexibility in terms of extenuating circumstances that may arise due to economics and other factors. But, and funny enough, the EU almost exercised Article 16 in terms of changing some of the agreement they had within this protocol. And they did that over COVID-19, the passing of COVID-19 vaccines. In the end, they pulled back pretty sharpish because there was a bit of a hue and cry. So Europe didn't go for it. But Britain certainly is. They're trying to trigger this Article 16, saying, look, it's part of the protocol that we're allowed to do this. But the game behind this really is more of a we don't care about Europe. And I think that in the long run, this isolationism that Britain seems to be heading in terms of, at least with Europe, will only make their own trading more and more difficult, given the constant threat of COVID-19 new strains coming out all the time, shutdowns of the economy, closures of the high streets, etc.
Mr. White in Edinburgh, Boris Johnson's government, he's warned that it will suspend parts of the agreement if the EU doesn't budge. The EU has threatened trade sanctions if Johnson unilaterally breaks his promises. If this row escalates any further, are we looking at the possibility of what many are labeling right now as a mini trade war?
Yes, but this will play politically into the hands of Boris Johnson and his administration, because this will dial up the anti-Europe xenophobia. This will play into the hands of the narrative that Britain is being put upon by this monolithic, tyrannical Brussels bureaucracy. And this will play well with the Brexit heartlands that has propelled him into power in 2019 and continues to maintain his popularity, regardless of all the scandals and the crises ushered into being by his failed policy on Brexit, on COVID. So Boris Johnson will seek to extrapolate as much political capital from this as possible. Brexit was always an emotionally driven political project. It was never about reason. It was never about rationality. It was never about bread and butter issues. It was all about a supposed reach, emotional reach back in time to a golden age where Britain ruled the waves, Britannia ruled the waves, and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased. Boris Johnson has more political acumen than his detractors would have us believe, and he understands base nationalism is a very, very powerful, powerful political force, and he's going to play to that in regards to his opposition to EU on the Northern Ireland Protocol.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. White. The rising cost of Brexit for Britain was divulged on Thursday as a new analysis showed quitting the EU had delivered an £18 billion blow to UK trade in goods. Now, if this impasse does continue, how will this affect the British economy?
Well, it will obviously affect it deleteriously, but this was never about economics, as I just said. This was all about emotion. It was about the legitimization of far-right tropes regarding British identity, immigration, and the representation and meaning of British history. It is the acme of British mythologies regarding British history and regarding Britain's place in the world. So it's never about been about economics, it's been about base nationalism, and it's a very, very dangerous motive force indeed.
Mr. Abbas, Ireland, it isn't where the line is drawn, pun intended there, as Gibraltar remains an issue in post-Brexit talks. Gibraltar's border with Spain, like that between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, is a divide between the EU and a non-EU Britain. What if the provisions of that temporary deal between the UK and Spain come into question?
Well, that does flare up very regularly, and I think it's being kept in check because of wheeling and dealing and behind-the-scenes negotiations. So it's still very much a vulnerable area, just as the Northern Ireland situation is. These are all flashpoints, and one does get the feeling that somebody somewhere certainly is quite happy to engineer these flashpoints, because all of this would bring back the old rule Britannia kind of mentality, and that is something which the Tories have definitely been stoking. They would be quite happy with Britain having a kind of a nationalistic, if you like, outlook and being more united. Don't forget that they're also internally battling the idea of Scottish independence, and the idea of Welsh independence has reared its head, and that the Scottish independence certainly hasn't gone away. In fact, it's gathering more pace. So Boris would need anything he can to try and sort of keep Britain together, because there's, of course, that threat of fragmentation of Britain due to Brexit, because the Scots aren't terribly happy with the way that England is certainly approaching the whole Brexit question. So yes, there are many, many issues which are really about territorial fragmentation, which Boris is risking as well. He would say that actually he's creating a rallying cry for a unified United Kingdom, and they're all for this kind of bringing back the old jingoism of empire days, almost, if they could. I mean, if it was down to Boris, he certainly would, but there's a limit to what they can do. It's manifesting on the street, of course, in Islamophobia, in a rise in racism. You saw, even with the English football players just recently, that the minute the English football players missed a bunch of penalties, and they happened to be black, there was a huge storm on social media in which there were racists who came out very openly attacking those black players. And of course, there's been a response, and it doesn't mean that everybody in Britain is racist, but this issue of xenophobia, this issue of racism, this issue of nationalism, as my colleague pointed out, is a major factor in winning political votes in the heartlands. And so perhaps that is more important to Boris than Britain's economic future. He probably won't be here when the real consequences of Brexit kick in, which will be that Britain will certainly not have as much wealth passing through it as it did given the trade it had with the EU.
Let's get a final thought from Mr. White. Is Boris Johnson's recent Asian presence, both the diplomacy push and also the announced South China Sea military deployments, do you think they're intended to divert attention from some of these post-Brexit uncertainties?
Absolutely. This is the politics of mass distraction. This is desperation. This is an attempt by Boris Johnson to assert Britain's stature on the world stage post-Brexit, trying to hark back to the ghosts of Britain's imperial past. But the great Labour leftist Nye Bevan said it best. A reactionary is a man walking backwards with his face to the future. I can think of no better summation of Brexit in our time. Britain is a post-colonial theme park, a 19th century post-colonial theme park, and in poetic irony, rather than ushering a new golden age for British imperial prestige on a world stage, it has only ushered in the coming breakup of the UK. And when that day comes, such a cry of freedom will ring out around the world, such as never been heard before.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, joining us from the British capital, London, and also thanks to writer and political analyst, John White, speaking to us from Edinburgh. Also, thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Republicans on Friday, 28th of May, blocked the creation of an independent commission to investigate the 6th of January Capitol riot, using their filibuster power in the Senate for the first time this year to doom a full accounting of the deadliest attack on Congress in centuries. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Nicholas Fandos and Emily Cottrain. The piece is titled, Senate Republicans Filibuster 6th of January Inquiry Bill Blocking an Investigation. Republicans on Friday, 28th of May, blocked the creation of an independent commission to investigate the 6th of January Capitol riot, using their filibuster power in the Senate for the first time this year to doom a full accounting of the deadliest attack on Congress in centuries. The vote was a stark display of political self-interest by Republicans determined to shield themselves from an inquiry that could have publicly tarnished their party. They feared an investigation that would remind voters of the consequences of former President Donald Trump's election lies and how Republican lawmakers indulged them, spurring their supporters to violence. Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader, has made a clear choice that his and his party's fortunes depend on putting the events of 6th of January behind them. It all but guaranteed that there would be no comprehensive nonpartisan inquiry into the attack's root causes, the former President Donald Trump's conduct, as his supporters threatened lawmakers and the vice president, or any connections between his allies in Congress and the rioters. While members of both political parties agreed in its immediate aftermath that an investigation was indeed needed, most Republicans have since toiled to put the episode behind them, and some have actively sought to deny or to play down the reality of what happened on 6th of January. On Friday, 28th of May, only six Republicans joined Democrats to support advancing the measure to create an independent commission. The final vote, 54-35, fell short of the 60 votes needed to move past a Republican filibuster. The vote was a stinging defeat for proponents of the commission. They had argued that the only way to assemble a truly complete account of the rioting for a polarized nation was through an inquiry modeled after the one into the 11th of September 2001 attacks, in which outside experts with subpoena power undertook a thorough study. Some Republicans expressed disgust with their own party for blocking it, saying that they had put politics over the finding of what promised to be a grim set of facts. "I don't want to know, but I need to know," said Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, one of six Republicans who voted to form the commission. To be making a decision for short-term political gain at the expense of understanding and acknowledging what was in front of us on 6th of January, I think we need to look at that critically. While the Justice Department has opened hundreds of criminal cases against rioters, and congressional committees are likely to expand nascent inquiries, they will almost certainly confront limits that a commission staffed with national security experts, jointly appointed by Republicans and Democrats, would not. Among them are partisanship, defiant witnesses, and turf wars that are likely to leave unanswered key questions about how the party rallied around Donald Trump's stolen election lies and his demands that Republicans invalidate Joseph Biden Jr.'s victory. Do my Republican colleagues remember that day? Senator Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York and a majority leader in the Senate, asked moments after the vote. Do my Republican colleagues remember the savage mob calling for the execution of former Vice President Mike Pence, the makeshift gallows outside the Capitol? Shame on the Republican Party for trying to sweep the horrors of that day under the rug because they're afraid of Donald Trump, he added. Top Republicans had entertained supporting the measure as recently as last week, but they ultimately reversed course, and the House approved it with only 35 Republican votes. Leaders concluded that open-ended scrutiny of the attack would hand Democrats powerful political ammunition before the 2022 midterm elections and enrage a former president they are intent on appeasing. I do not believe the additional extraneous commission that Democratic leaders want would uncover crucial new facts or promote healing, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader in the Senate, said on the eve of the vote. Mitch McConnell added, "Frankly, I do not believe it is even designed to do that." Though Mitch McConnell said he would continue to support criminal cases against the rioters and stand by his unflinching criticisms of Donald Trump, the commission's defeat is likely to only embolden the former President Donald Trump at a time when he has once again ramped up circulation of his baseless and debunked claims. Republicans had already saved Donald Trump from conviction in two impeachment trials. In a matter of months, Trump's lies have warped the views of many of his party's supporters who view President Joe Biden as illegitimate. They have also inspired a rash of new voting restrictions in Republican-led states and a quixotic recount in Arizona denounced by both political parties. And they have fueled efforts by Republican members of Congress to diminish and reframe the Capitol riot as a benign event akin to a normal tourist visit. People are just now beginning to understand, Donald Trump wrote in a statement on Thursday, 27th of May. Democrats denounced the vote and warned Republicans that preventing an independent inquiry would not shield them from confronting the implications of Donald Trump's attacks on the democratic process. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York and the majority leader in the Senate, and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi are now planning their own committee investigations into the rioting and attack on 6th of January, how it was coordinated and why the government failed to prevent an assault that left several people dead, the Capitol building ransacked, and those inside the Capitol building at risk. Nancy Pelosi could also set up a select committee focused solely on the attack, handing Democrats unilateral subpoena power and a much longer timeline to investigate whatever they want. Chuck Schumer seemingly endorsed the idea on Friday afternoon, saying it was better to investigate with a select committee than not investigate at all. Progressives seized on the Republicans' opposition to the commission as new justification to press their case for invoking the so-called nuclear option to rewrite the filibuster rule and allow bills to pass on simple majority votes. Activists have pressed Democratic leaders to do so and then skirt Republican opposition to enact pressing liberal priorities like a sweeping voting rights measure, gun control legislation, legislation of undocumented immigrants, and much more. if the Republicans can't agree to the independent commission investigating the first armed insurrection at the Capitol in our nation's history, then something has gone badly wrong, said Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat from Massachusetts. Elizabeth Warren added, and that something is the filibuster. But changing the rules would require the agreement of all 50 Democrats, and at least two oppose the move. One of them, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, said that his position was unchanged. I'm not willing to destroy our government, no, Joe Manchin said. Still, after an 11th-hour scramble with Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, to draft a compromise to address some of her party's stated concerns about the legislation, Joe Manchin concluded that most would not support it and were simply cycling through disingenuous reasons to vote no. I'm very, very disappointed, very frustrated that politics has trumped, literally and figuratively, the good of the country, he told reporters after the vote. The six Republican senators who voted to advance debate on the commission included Susan Collins, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Bob Portman of Ohio, Mitt Romney of Utah, and Ben Sasse of Nebraska. All but Rob Portman had voted at an impeachment trial in February to find Donald Trump guilty of inciting the insurrection and rioting. A seventh Republican, Senator Patrick J. Toomey of Pennsylvania, missed the vote, one of 11 senators to do so, but said he would have voted to advance debate on the commission. Bill Cassidy of Louisiana argued his party was also making a strategic mistake in blocking the commission, giving Democrats reason to pursue partisan investigations of what happened on 6th of January with or without the Republicans. To ensure the investigations are fair, impartial, and focused on the facts, Republicans need to be involved in the investigations, Bill Cassidy said. After his own flirtation with supporting the bill, Mitch McConnell worked aggressively to quash support. To convince his colleagues that Democrats were acting in bad faith despite the bipartisan nature of the commission, Mitch McConnell circulated an interview with James Carville, the Democratic strategist, urging his party to make the Republicans own that insurrection every day. It was a marked shift for Mitch McConnell, reflecting how his political calculus has changed since 6th of January. Though he made some of his party's most stinging condemnations of Donald Trump's attempt to undermine the election outcome, the minority leader has now made a clear decision that his party's fortune and his own personal fortunes depend on putting the events of 6th of January firmly behind them in favor of attacking Joe Biden's agenda. In rejecting the commission, Republicans resisted emotional appeals from those affected by the rioting to drop their opposition. The mother and longtime girlfriend of a Capitol police officer who died after clashing with the mob on 6th of January led an emotional last-ditch lobbying campaign on the eve of the vote, teaming with police officers who had responded to the assault. I couldn't stay quiet anymore, said Gladys Sicknick, the mother of police officer Brian Sicknick, who died after the 6th of January riot and assault. The group also included Michael Fanone, a Washington police officer who was brutalized by rioters and pleaded with them to spare his life, and also Harry Dunn, a Capitol police officer who is black and faced a slew of racist slurs during the attack.
Of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.